Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Yaron Brook Show. I'm ARI fellow Dom Watkins sitting in for Yaron Brook. So today's really exciting for me. We're going to be having a guest who's actually my favorite living economist to discuss monetary freedom and monetary reform. So after the 2008 financial crisis, that's when I actually seriously started studying economics. And I read a lot of different thinkers and learned a lot, but it wasn't until I found the work of today's guest that I really felt like I could make sense of monetary theory and monetary history. And so I'm really pleased to introduce George Selgin to the show. George, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Great. Great to have you. So George is a senior fellow and director. Yeah, absolutely. At the Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives at the Cato Institute and professor emeritus of economics at the University of Georgia. And he's also one of the founders, along with Kevin Dowd and Larry White, of the Modern Free Banking School. So, George, I wanted to dive right in. We have a ton to cover, and I'm sure we won't get through every issue in monetary history.
I suppose not. There's an awful lot of it.
For sure. So whenever we talk about the state of the economy, we're often – one of the topics that comes up is, you know, what should the Fed do? And I think – it's appropriate that at the time we're recording this, the Fed should be announcing whether or not they're going to raise or keep interest rates where they are. But whenever you're talking about, you know, what an institution should do, like the Fed is not a law of nature. Indeed, I mean, historically, it's a relatively recent creation. And so there's a real question of should we have one or not? And if so, what should its purpose be? Because that's going to be how we judge what it should do. Now, I personally, I'm a champion of laissez-faire capitalism. Yaron Brook, who is, you know, the main host of this show, is certainly one. And, you know, our view is there shouldn't be a central planner of money and interest rates any more than there should be of shoes or bicycle prices. But to say that's a controversial view would be an understatement. And so I think
part of
the reason why that's so controversial is that there's a kind of simple narrative about life before and after the Fed. And basically, you can say before the Fed, we had laissez-faire banking in America. The result was wildcat banking, constant panics and bank failures. And then we created the Fed and, I guess, insert parentheses, setting aside the Great Depression, the inflation of the 70s, the S&L crisis, the Great Recession, close parentheses. Things have been better ever since. I want to start with, could you describe briefly, like, what was America's banking system prior to the Fed? Were there real problems, and if so, was it because we had this unprecedented amount of freedom?
So, Don, yes, I've heard a million times people tell the story of all that trouble we had before the Fed and how it was caused by the laissez-faire. And the truth is that America never had a free market banking system or anything close to it. Can you hear me, Don? I've got an echo in my phone.
It's coming in a little faintly, but I don't hear an echo.
Okay. The truth is, we never had anything like a free market, and what we did have was a banking system that was rife with problems, because of all kinds of government interference. I'm getting that echo again, Don. I'm sorry. I've got to put you on speaker. Before the Civil War, you had a bunch of problems in the system, depending on the states, and most of the worst problems of bank failures and bad currency, etc., have been traced for that era by economic historians, plenty of them, to government interference by this with these state banking systems. But let's talk about what happened after the Civil War briefly, because it's the period after that that brought a number of severe financial crises that led eventually to the creation of the Fed. Monetary historians have also studied these crises, and they do not attribute them to laissez-faire. It has been very thoroughly documented that the cause of those crises also resided in government interference. Specifically, the federal government would not allow the banks that it chartered, called national banks, to have branches, and it would only allow them to issue currency if they backed the currency with U.S. government bonds, something that they were required to do as a condition for getting charters in order originally to help sell bonds to pay for the Civil War. In any event, these two kinds of interference, combined with laws, a law also passed during the Civil War, made it possible for state banks to issue notes, currency, and almost drove all of them out of business, together set the stage for these terrible crises. And it follows that if these government interventions had not taken place, there would have been no crises and there would have been no call for further reforms or for a central bank. Now, the way I put that sounds like a counterfactual, because it is. However, we also have a real-world example that is extremely compelling, namely Canada. Canada had the same gold standard as the U.S., the same dollar, essentially, which was, for this period, defined by a unit of gold. Canada had a much less diverse and much smaller economy, but those facts should have made it harder for it to sustain a safe and stable monetary and banking system, not easier, other things equal. Yet Canada had none of those crises. It was remarkably stable because whatever other disadvantages it had, it allowed its banks to freely branch, it allowed them to freely issue currency in response to market demands, and as a result, it didn't run into severe currency shortages and large numbers of bank failures, which struck the United States almost every decade and sometimes to a lesser extent more often than that. So
let me get clear on one.
So that's the basic background on that.
So that's really helpful. But so I can see the I think it's easy to see the branch banking restrictions, right? When banks can't branch, then they'd have no diversification. So if you're a bank in Texas and the oil fields, price of oil goes down, you're going to go out of business. Whereas if you can branch, one place that's booming can support places that are falling on tough times. I think it's less obvious. What was the problem with the national banks being limited to how much currency they could issue because it had to be backed by government bonds?
So I'll turn to that last question, but first let me point out the problem by not letting banks branch. Yes, they prevented them from being well-diversified institutions, and that in itself was terrible. But the prohibition of branching had other consequences that were often even more serious, one of which was that the banks, instead of maintaining and controlling their own reserves, if they were in the countryside, would deposit funds with correspondents in the city and ultimately with a handful of correspondent banks in New York City in order to be able to tap into those other markets that they couldn't access directly by having branches in them. And this led to what was called at the time the problem of the concentration of reserves in New York, and also to what's called the pyramiding of reserves. The details are perhaps not going into, but the bottom line was that a dollar's worth of gold in New York was often reckoned as a part of the reserves of no fewer than three banks at a time, which was all well and good so long as they were all willing to leave their reserves in New York. But if, as happened often enough, the banks in the countryside needed their reserves, and they often needed them because they couldn't issue currency enough, so that is enough of their own notes, which is the point I'm going to get to, you could have this incredible scramble for reserves in New York that would force the New York banks to suspend payments of reserves, that is, to disappoint their correspondents, and this would lead to a panic all over the country. So the lack of branching was a cause of trouble, not just for the usual diversification reason, but for other reasons as well. Now, what about the fact that banks were required, national banks, which were the only ones now issuing their own circulating currency notes, to back those notes with government bonds? Now, let's remember, this is a time when payments often are cash payments, whereas today we've moved far away from that. In those days, there weren't that many payments that you could make by check, and of course there were no credit cards or debit cards or whatever. In certain times of year especially, the harvest being the most important, the need for currency, circulating paper money to make payments, was exceptional because the itinerant workers who harvested the crops had to be paid. Well, normally banks that needed to do that would just allowed farmers who have been holding deposits at those banks to convert the deposits into the bank's own notes, which are similar IOUs, so that nothing would change. The banks would have the same number of outstanding IOUs and the same assets and the same reserves. The IOUs would just be taking a different more form, more convenient for the farmers' needs. Well, okay.
Okay.
That's all the background. Sorry. And now a little more. Here's the problem. The law required that the banks back their notes with specific assets, government securities. And I'm getting a lot of echo again, Hassan. I don't know what it is. I hear myself. And but that meant that if they couldn't acquire the necessary government securities for a reasonable price, they would not be able to supply their customers with currency when they needed to. But after 1870, and really just not long after the Civil War, the federal government started running budget deficits, and it was reducing the amount of its outstanding debt. So those bonds that the banks needed as backing for the notes became more and more scarce, more and more expensive, and more unprofitable to own. In fact, the banks found it very profitable to sell the bonds that they were holding to back their notes in order to realize capital gains on them. Bottom line, the supply of currency, it should have been growing in a then rapidly growing economy, actually fell to half the level in 1890 that it was at, less than half the level it was at in a decade before, which is crazy. So we had a currency system that, instead of being responsive to changing market needs, was responsive to the state of the government's accounts. And just to put that finally in a more stark term, if the government had eventually paid off its debt, which is something we would normally consider necessarily a disastrous thing to do, if it had done so back then, there literally would have been no paper currency in the entire United States because this law wouldn't allow it. That's a good example of perverse currency legislation. And again, it's stuff like that that made crises happen that then provided the impetus for the Fed, which was a poor solution to those crises. The better solution, that's dictated by the facts I've just related, would have been to deregulate the system, that is to get rid of the pesky laws that were making it malfunction in the first place.
Yeah, I want to come back to why that didn't happen, why we went in the direction of a central bank. But I want to take a step back. And if you could just explain, you know, what is free banking, this at a more theoretical level? And if you could distinguish it or relate it to something that's often equated with it, which is the idea of a gold standard.
Yes, it's to some extent it's easiest for me to sort of lump those questions together, because traditionally, meaning in the days where the standard money consisted of gold or perhaps silver, if not both, free banking simply meant that you let banks be free, all of them, to issue currency, as well as let them be free from most other important, that is, unusual government regulations. So the U.S. system lacked this freedom, the one I was just describing, because it hampered banks' ability to issue notes, although it did let all national banks issue currency on some conditions, and it didn't let them branch, and there were other regulations as well. Canada's system came closer to a true free banking system because the banks there could issue currency notes, their own currency notes, without very many important restrictive regulations, and they could branch freely. Canadian banks were, though, subject to some important regulatory restrictions, so they weren't perfectly free. Most importantly, there wasn't freedom of entry into the system. It was not easy. It was practically impossible for new banks to enter. That's a big departure from the ideal of free banking. The most famous old actual free banking system was the Scottish banking system that flourished in the first half of the 19th century and a little bit before, where there were really very, very few significant government regulations. Okay, so historically, the point is, free banking has been associated with gold and silver standards, and it was easy enough to conceive of because it meant that instead of having a single bank with a privileged issue paper currency, banks were allowed to compete in that part of the banking business. Central banking, in contrast, meant that you gave one bank a monopoly of currency or something close. So that's the historical context. Today, though, it raises a problem. When we speak about free banking today, what do we mean? Because we have a fiat monetary system. So, and as long as we keep that system, the only thing that free banking can mean is that we let other banks be free to issue currency notes that are themselves IOUs to the fiat money issued by the Fed. That, in that case, though, having free banking no longer means not having a central bank, because you still have to have an institution that supplies the standard money, and you're assuming that it's still a fiat money. And you can't let banks compete and issue currency that isn't convertible, because no one is certain that that would lead to anything but a disaster. So free banking today, you have to define very carefully what you mean, and it doesn't automatically follow from saying that you think free banking is a good thing today, that you mean that you can completely get rid of the Federal Reserve lock, stock, and barrel. You could if you could get a gold standard or silver standard back again, but if you're not going to do that, if you're going to keep a fiat monetary standard, unfortunately you need some mechanism that's going to supply that fiat money, that's going to regulate that supply. It could be a simple mechanism like just keep what you've got and never increase it again. That's a regulatory mechanism, but that might not be the best you can do.
So this raises one controversy I definitely want to touch on, a controversy at least among free market supporters. So the systems that you've described as essentially or largely free, Canada, Scotland, in certain respects, America, you have a situation in which there's fractional reserve banking, that banks are, you know, taking in money and not holding it all in the vault, but lending most of it out in terms of loans and then or buying other assets, but you know, holding, let's say, a fixed or a smaller amount of gold on hand for people to redeem. There's other people, particularly associated with Murray Rothbard, and the Mises Institute, who regard fractional reserve banking both as fraudulent and as economically destructive. And I've read a lot of your criticisms of this. I certainly find them compelling myself. But could you just briefly outline what are the essential arguments that are made against fractional reserve, and why do you think that they are, why those arguments actually don't hold up?
Okay, I'll take a step at it at the risk of oversimplification. As you said, I've written quite a lot of this, so much that I don't think I'll bother writing anymore, but I don't mind summarizing some of the points I've made. First of all, with regard to ethics, there's simply no truth, first of all, to the suggestion that's sometimes made that fractional reserve lending, which is, by the way, the only kind of lending a true intermediary can engage in, 100% reserve institution isn't lending, it's a warehouse. But in any event, the claim that this was done surreptitiously, that is, that bank depositors didn't know that their money was being lent, there's very little substantive evidence of this, and I think you'd have to be, well, let's put it this way, to be blunt. If the folks at the Mises Institute can figure out that banks are lending money, I don't suppose there are lots of people who wouldn't also be able to figure it out. Of course, there's a theory according to which that's not true, which is the theory that the folks at the Mises Institute are really substantially more intelligent than other people in the world. I'll leave it to your listeners to decide whether that theory is compelling. But in fact, we have plenty of reason to believe that people have known from the earliest days of fractional reserve banking that their money was being lent out, starting with the fact that more often than not, they've been earning interest on the IOUs they've kept at the banks, which is hardly possible if the bank is incurring costs on your behalf. It would have to charge you money if it weren't earning some money using the money you brought to it. I've written about the case of the old English banks in a paper called Those Dishonest Goldsmiths, showing that even in the mid-17th century, the early days of the goldsmith bankers, there was every reason to believe that the relatively sophisticated persons who did business with those banks, because they were risky institutions, knew perfectly well that their money was being lent, even back then. Today, sometimes people say, you know how you can frame survey questions in a misleading way? If you say to somebody, do you think the money you deposited into the bank is still there? Well, what they mean when they say yes is they still have a balance at the bank, which is true, but that balance is itself an IOU. If you asked a different question, you say, do you think banks lend your money? I think most people would say, well, of course they lend money. So framing the question is important. In any event, there's nothing to the fraud argument. If you read your bank contract at all carefully, you'll see that it's very explicit. And I've also somewhere posted a post showing that warehouse receipts historically have completely different language than banknotes have ever had. And the difference is very clear. The warehouse receipts indicate unambiguously that some stuff has been stored. The bank deposits only say that the bank will pay you some amount when you ask for it. Those are two different kinds of contracts. One's a lending contract or debt contract of sorts. The other is a warehouse or bailment contract, completely different. Okay, so that's fraud. I could say more, but...
Well, I guess one...
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, one question I did want to raise, and maybe this will second part could come up more in the second part of the answer. A lot of our listeners, I think, are fans of Mises himself, and in my reading, he's kind of ambiguous on this issue. He doesn't seem to hold the fraud view, but it's not clear to me which side he takes in this argument. Do you know that offhand?
He doesn't take the fraud view, but on the question of whether fractional reserve banking is desirable or not, I agree with you that he's ambiguous. My good friend and former colleague and mentor, Larry White, has mustered evidence from Mises' writings to the effect that he thought fractional reserve banking was a good thing. It was perfectly fine and desirable. But I believe someone with some, perhaps a little more effort could muster statements from Mises, and I've seen some of these statements, that suggest that he didn't think it was a good thing. So I think that Mises' views, they may not have been inconsistent, they may simply have changed over the years. Don't ask me how or when and in which direction. But so what? Mises is an economist, one of many. We don't have to rely on him to address these questions. If he's ambiguous in any way, we must turn to thinking about it in other ways, perhaps consulting other sources. But there are two different questions here, or several different questions, but one is whether what banks are doing is legitimate in the sense of legally legitimate and on the up and up and everyone knows what's going on. The other is whether what they're doing has adverse consequences for the economy and whether we'd be better off if we didn't let them do it. But here I would just like to insist that, first of all, when banks are lending normally in a competitive system, nothing I'm about to say goes for central banks, which can create money out of thin air. Ordinary banks can't do that. They're constrained, for the most part, to really behave as go-betweens or intermediaries, which means they have little opportunity to engage in lending that isn't a response to the willingness of other parties, of their depositors, first of all, but also other potential other persons, to hold on to their liabilities. Right? So if I decide to hold on to an IOU from someone, or to accumulate IOUs from someone, essentially I'm granting that person the opportunity and the right to spend money in my place. And that's what an intermediary does. It takes your savings, gives you its IOU, and then employs your savings as it wishes. When you put deposits in the bank, by the way, the money that you put there ceases to be your property, becomes the banker's property. This is part of the ethical point. What you own is a claim against the bank for the same quantity of money. That's not the same as owning the money. And this is something that the Austrians who complain about fraud get wrong repeatedly. So you have a valid claim, but a valid claim to something isn't the same thing as the thing it's a claim to itself. So anyway, banks give you their IOUs, then they turn around and spend in your place. As long as all banks do is to enable other spending by their borrowers, that replaces the spending others their customers had to not do in order for the banks to get more of their IOUs out there, then the banks are not creating money. They are, that is, they're not creating credit, pardon me. They're transferring credit. That is, they're allowing persons to to borrow because other persons are saving and they're acting as go-betweens. And there's no business cycle ramifications of that. In Hayekian terms, it doesn't cause forced savings. It doesn't mean interest rates are forced below their natural levels. It doesn't mean inflation. It doesn't mean an unsustainable boom. Those things happen or can happen if money is indeed created out of thin air, which is to say borrowing is enabled even though no one has stopped spending or has no non-bank persons have refrained from spending to hold on to IOUs instead. So the claim that fractional reserve banking leads to business cycles and instability is wrong. So, by the way, is the claim that fractional reserve banking leads to inflation, except that I have to qualify that. If you go from a world where we're all using gold to one where we introduce banks, and let's just say banking catches on really fast, and the next thing you know, we're holding bank IOUs, and the banks find they only need 1% reserves. In that world, if it's a closed economy, prices are going to rise in terms of gold. But you might as well see this as gold becoming less popular because good substitutes are now available. So there's a one-time, and in this case, dramatic decline in the demand for gold and rise in increase in gold's and decline in gold's real value, which is an increase in the general level of prices of other things. But once we're in equilibrium in that new system, the reserve ratio doesn't change that much. And therefore, let's say it's still 1%. And by the way, that's not an unrealistic figure for a good, efficient free banking system. The Scottish banks often held that amount of gold or even less. Then the inflation rate is still the rate at which the gold supply grows. So in other words, if you have a gold supply grows 10% a year in a 100% reserve system, or you have the gold supply grow 10% a year in a 1% reserve gold standard system that's been established for some time, the inflation rate in both systems is 10%, right? The presence of fractional reserves, or the level of the value of the fractional reserve ratio, doesn't have anything to do with the inflation rate once a fractional reserve of some stability has been established. I don't know if all that helps, but it's all relevant.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, a good place to go for people who are interested in this, I highly recommend the blog that you write for and help edit, the Alt M blog, and we link to that in the show notes. And particularly, I think the early posts that carry over from your old free banking blog, there's a lot of stuff that goes into detail on this. But let's return. So we have this story where the American system does have problems, but it's problems that are associated with government intervention. Many people recognize that it's the government intervention. They're pointing to Canada and saying, look, if we got rid of these restrictions, we would have a much more stable system. And yet what we get in 1913 or ultimately 1914 is a Federal Reserve. So why did we go in a different direction?
Well, I'm glad you're asking that question, because I not long ago wrote a paper all about just this. And if anyone wants to read it, they can also find it online. It's called New York's Bank, the National Monetary Commission and the Founding of the Fed. In a nutshell, what happened is this. For about, for not quite 10 years, for a little over 10 years, between the panic of 1893 and the panic of 1907, most of the legislative attempts to improve the U.S. monetary system consisted of laws that would indeed have deregulated the system and in some cases deregulated it along Canadian lines. It has make it look a lot more like Canada's then successful system. So everyone understood who was writing these laws, and a lot of other people did as well, that there were regulations that were responsible for the crises, and that getting rid of them would go a long way if it wouldn't solve the crises altogether. However, those efforts were repeatedly frustrated by a powerful Republican senator named Nelson Aldrich, who was in the pocket of the big Wall Street banks. Now, you might say, why wouldn't the Wall Street banks want to end these crises? The answer has to do with what I was mentioning to you before about one of the problems of the lack of branch banking. As long as you didn't allow banks to branch, they ended up sending huge amounts of their reserves to New York, where they stayed at least until the harvest season, because they couldn't get to that market otherwise, and it was the most convenient thing to do. And the law allowed them to count those reserves legally towards their minimum reserve requirements. In short, a handful of New York banks benefited tremendously from the lack of branch banking, if not from some of the other regulations that were behind the pre-Fed troubles. So while they might have been interested in some reforms, these banks weren't interested in anything that would deprive them of their correspondent business, which, by the way, for many of them was more than half of their total business. So it was not small beer. So they had Aldrich block all these reforms. After the 1907 panic, he couldn't just block reforms because everybody said, look, we've got to do something. So his tune changed. He became a big advocate of reform, and he became the chairman of the National Monetary Commission, which law passed after the 1907 panic, charged with coming up with a reform plan. So he and his friends in New York got together in the famous Jekyll Island meeting that everyone now knows about, which was top secret then, to hash out a plan for reform that would allow the New York bankers to maintain their hegemony and their business in New York, including all that correspondent money, but would still appear to provide a way of dealing with crises, because nobody was going to not allow some reform to take place. So they, in other words, hijacked the reform movement. They didn't actually author the Federal Reserve Act. They all authored the Republican measure, of course, which was called, or which everyone called, the Aldrich Plan. When Wilson was elected, of course, his party wasn't going to support that plan, and the Democrats by then also had a majority in Congress. But they didn't have any plan of their own, and when they finally patched one together, they did so. There's a long story here, too. But by borrowing huge chunks of the former Aldrich plan, modifying it in some ways that were more important, but in many that were not so important, and ending up with a Federal Reserve, with an act that actually served the needs of Wall Street just about as well as the Aldrich plan would have. And indeed, if you look at what happens after the Federal Reserve Act is passed, not only do those bankers' balances in the big New York banks stay put, in quantity at least, if not in exactly which banks were supplying them, but they zoom up. The Fed was the best thing that happened to these Wall Street banks. Unfortunately, it wasn't such a great thing when it came to ending crises, which was what it was supposed to do, because, as everyone knows, there were more crises in the first 20 years of the Fed, and worse ones, than in the preceding 20 years, so much for that. Of course, that doesn't stop Fed officials and many other economists from repeating how much the Fed has helped stabilize the U.S. economy, even though there is absolutely no evidence to sustain that claim, and plenty of evidence that seems to contradict it. I've written about that as well, by the way. Did I call you to fall asleep, Don? You're still there.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. We had a microphone problem. There's a paper that you co-authored, I believe, called "Has the Fed Been a Failure?" Where you go
That's
through
right.
the history. I we'll also link to that. I found that really fascinating because there's if you take it, everybody takes it as self-evident that setting aside the Great Depression, or at least the whole era leading up to the Great Depression, the Fed has made things much more stable than prior to its creation. And what you guys show is that's really hard to find in the evidence. That's
exactly right. And thank you, Don, for putting it that way, because I have and my co-authors have been taken to task by people who say, well, you don't do a proper counterfactual exercise, so your paper can't be taken seriously. And I point out to these people, I said, look, what our paper concludes isn't that the Fed did not stabilize things. It's that the claim that it did is not supported by research or evidence so far. That is, no one has actually supported, nobody's actually provided any proof that that's true. And the prima facie case that one can build by just looking at the raw statistics and at some other evidence and some work done by people that addresses particular parts of the question, all of it suggests that the Fed has, if anything, made things worse. Has it? We don't know for sure. But look, all I said is that the people who defend the Fed haven't proven the case. not a day goes by when Fed economists don't claim that they have made things more stable, and yet nobody goes after them and says, well, you haven't really established that, including some of the economists who criticized our work. Anyway, you can tell it really gets me hot and bothered because we were very careful in how we put our conclusions, and we put them the way you just put it.
So, you know, I want to come a little bit to the current situation, although we keep calling it, you know, the recent financial crisis, almost a decade. What role do you see the Fed playing there, both in the lead up and the aftermath to the crisis?
I agree with those, including John Taylor, who claimed, first of all, that the Fed kept interest rates too low in the 2000s, the noughts, and that this was one factor, but only one, that helped to fuel the subprime lending boom, which incidentally was more than a subprime boom. It was a general lending boom. David Beckworth and I and a third author named Barak Bahadir, who was my colleague at Georgia, we have a paper that's come out that details, using all kinds of statistics, how the Fed's policy actions contributed to the boom, but also how its actions contributed to the bust, because especially in 2008 and early 2009, but to some extent, long afterwards, Fed policy was, according to our estimates, too tight. So it contributed to the boom and it contributed to the bust as well. This is, by the way, an old story, because it's typical for regulators, including the Fed, to turn a blind eye to booms as they develop and that they may be fueling, and then batten down the hatches once trouble breaks out. That's what the Fed did in the late 1920s and then early 1930s, loosening too much, tightening too much. And that's what it's done again, and there have been many times in between.
Let me pause on that or underline that, because I think that's there's a lot of kind of free market commentators who seem to treat the only thing that the Fed can do bad is creating too much money, and then kind of anything it does otherwise is, that, like, that's the only bad thing. And so that if you have a collapse, we should, you know, let the deflation occur, let the market correct, and that any other activity by the Fed, such as trying to keep spending from collapsing, that's considered intervention, and that's negative. And you're taking a different view here in terms of I think the implication is that if spending is collapsing following what we might call an inflationary boom, there are things that a central bank, should you have one, can and should do. Is that right?
Yes, but remember the context. We're stuck with a central bank regulating our money right now, whether we like it or not. Now, if we didn't have a central bank and we had a proper free banking system, we would have not a constant money supply, not a shrinking money supply. We would have a money supply that, well, who knows how it would behave, but it might also expand. And indeed, I've argued that under free banking, there's a tendency for expansion when there's a liquidity crisis and people want to hold more money. So what we want, ideally, is a central bank that does that mimics as much as possible what a well-working market-based system would be. What people who only worry about inflation or think central banks can, or who claim that central banks can only err in the direction of causing inflation, they neglect that central banks, being central planners, can err every which way. And that means they can sometimes err relative to a properly designed or a developed market system. They can err by creating too little money or allowing too little to be created. And they do this all the time. It's true that history shows a long-run bias to inflation, certainly it did until recent times. But that bias is punctuated by occasional serious bouts of deflation, for which central banks are also typically to blame. Now, there's another fallacy that kind of informs the thinking that you refer to sometimes. It's a misunderstanding of the Austrian boom-bust theory, of which Austrians themselves are sometimes guilty. The theory says that too much money creation will cause a boom, and then there'll be an inevitable bust. Rather, the prices will be distorted, but eventually they'll have to come back to their proper levels, and that's what's going to end the boom and generate or trigger the bust. But all of this happens, if you understand the theory correctly, all of this happens without any need for monetary contraction on the part of the central bank. It's sufficient that it doesn't keep on expanding excessively. That is, that it ceases and desists from expanding, or even if it tries to keep expanding and expands faster and faster, it's either going to get and create an inflationary crack-up boom, as Mises called it, or eventually relative prices are going to come back. The whole point is that the boom is unsustainable no matter what the central bank does. So the relative prices will come back in the line, even if the central bank expands or if it just stops expanding. And the bust will consist of the realization that profits aren't what they looked like, and a reorientation of investment. Now, none of this requires that the central bank contract money. The monetary contraction is only its own source of further distortions of relative prices and further pain and suffering, not a corrective to the prior excess expansion. And here I want myself to defer to the authority of von Mises, who very wisely answered a student who thought, gosh, if we've had inflation, then we need deflation to correct the mistakes. He said, well, if you ran over your neighbor's cat, would you back over the cat to make up for it? The point is that the best you can do is just let bygones be bygones, stop creating too much money, but don't start creating too little. That's how the economy is going to get back on its feet. That's how relative prices are going to fall into their proper order, and that's how resources are going to end up being used efficiently again, more or less. So deflation in the sense of monetary contraction is generally not desirable. Now, that I should qualify that. Deflation that is the result not of a deliberate attempt to make prices fall on the part of central banks, but a result of rapid economic growth that makes goods more available because their cost of production is falling, that sort of deflation is something I've always or long defended. It's productivity-driven or supply-driven deflation, which is very healthy if we would only allow it. What we don't want is deflation that's caused by a collapse of spending or a contraction of spending, caused by central banks' positive actions or by its failure to accommodate exceptional liquidity demands.
Yeah, and for I highly recommend to people who are interested in just this point your book, or it's really a book, Less Than Zero, where you go into this, and I think it's a really interesting take on these issues. I found it really clarifying. But I guess that leads to the question. There's an ongoing debate today about, you know, what is the state of Federal Reserve policy? There's the kind of I think what I often hear from kind of free market people, and I don't mean necessarily economists, but just people who try to follow these issues, is, well, clearly we have a massive expansionary policy where we're making the same mistakes again. But I think there's also, you know, one of the points that the market monitors have made is that I think I found interesting and valuable, is that you can't just look at interest rates and conclude whether money is too tight or too loose, that it's a much harder question to answer. And I wonder if you could give your assessment of where we are right now with the path the Fed has taken since the financial crisis.
Well, it's a good question where the Fed is right now, because of course one needs to be careful. It's hard to judge at the moment, at any moment, whether the Fed stance is what it ought to be. because the proof only comes later on. I can say, though, that that the Fed stance and that of the ECB, there's no evidence, no good evidence, that those stances have been excessively loose. And the market monetarists are right. You can't just look at interest rates, which are low in part because we've been in a recession or in a not impressive recovery from a recession. Interest rates were low in the 1930s. Interest rates can be low either because the money supply is growing excessively rapidly, and then they'll only be low for a while, and they'll eventually be very high, or they can be low because there is a very low demand for credit. That lack of demand for credit has been part of the story since the crisis broke out in a big way in 2008. So in any event, low interest rates today don't mean that the easy money is at play. Other indicators also suggest that money hasn't been particularly easy. It's notorious that inflation is subdued, even to the point of being lower than where the Fed wants it to be, if not lower than where some of us would like it to be. Spending, likewise, has not been growing very rapidly. The only thing that clearly has grown rapidly in the last 2 years has been the Fed's balance sheet. And it's true that normally this tremendous expansion in the Fed's balance sheet by trillions of dollars would lead to corresponding expansion in other nominal magnitudes, prices, etc. But, of course, this is not a normal situation. It's a situation where, as much as the Fed has created vast new reserves, the bank's willingness to hoard those reserves, that is to maintain excess reserves, has increased just as much. And so this new Federal Reserve money has not, for the most part, made its way into the economy, or it's made its way in, but not to an extent at all proportionate with what might have been expected. So it's not wise to suggest that money has been particularly loose or dangerously loose in recent times, because there's a preponderance of indicators that go in a different direction. The other thing I'd like to mention, though, is that a monetary policy nowadays doesn't work the way it used to, and so we also have to be careful how we interpret the Fed's rate movements, because when the Fed changes its targets today, it's not doing what it used to do. It used to be injecting reserves or withdrawing reserves from the marketplace. Now it's playing around with a set of completely administrative interest rates, the rate it pays banks to hold reserves, which is one of the factors that encourages them to hoard such reserves, and the rate it essentially pays other depository institutions and money market funds through its overnight reverse repo program. So it's playing around with all these rates, but that doesn't have the same significance that changing its target rates in the past would have. And the real point here is that it's by no means the case, I believe, that the Fed's monetary control mechanisms are working in the way that they used to work. We all agree they didn't always work very well before, but now, even if everything, now it's not clear that the Fed is really in control of things the way it was before, because its interest rate targets don't work in the same way, and it doesn't get the signals by having those targets that it used to have. I know that's vague, but we could go into it more, but there's not that much time.
Yeah, I wish we had a few more hours. But since we don't, I guess the two things I want to end on is, one, if your recommendation for you know, what do we do going forward? And I think we've talked about kind of what an ideal solution would look like, at least in pattern. But how do you think about kind of a next best solution in the near term that might actually be politically feasible if still difficult to achieve? And then I wonder if you could give advice on somebody who's just starting to get into these issues, where to start. Because, I mean, I definitely recommend your books. And even your blog, I think, is good for people just getting their feet wet. But most of the stuff you write, I think, is at a more advanced level. So what is a good starting place for somebody? So if you want to take those, whatever order you prefer.
Well, concerning the last question, I do want to mention that one series of posts I've had on my blog is comprised of what I'm calling a monetary policy primer, which is meant for people who aren't experts. And I just this week published the seventh part of that primer, which will end up having something like 13 parts, perhaps more. And those are more or less for beginners. They require some background knowledge, but not that much. So I would recommend that while people are perusing the blog, that they might consider starting by looking at that series, first of all. Regarding other books, to begin with, it's really kind of tricky. There used to be some little handbooks on money that were fine starting points for learning the subject. I'm afraid that most of those are long out of print. In fact, and that nothing's replaced them of the same kind. One of my favorite books about money, though I disagree with parts of it, is a Victorian essay by William Stanley Jevons that I still recommend, called Money and the Mechanism of Exchange. Of course, it's about 140 years out of date, but it's got a lot of good stuff on it. And if you want to learn about what things were like back then, especially, it's a great book, and it's available online for free from the wonderful library, online library of Liberty. So that's a book people might look at, and provided they understand that things have changed a lot in some cases, but it's great on the institutional background and history. So those are a couple of things I would recommend right off bat. There's also somewhere, I think, on our web page, we have a reading list for the Center for Monetary and Financial Interest. We're planning to work more on that so that people will get more advice about what to read, and it's going to emphasize online stuff. But those are the things that come to mind right away. I want to leave a little time, though, for the other part of your question regarding where do we go. I'd like to start by saying, look, you have one big choice to make when you're in the business of monetary reform or just wanting to think about it. And that choice is between wanting to save the dollar, which is our present currency, that is the predominant one, or not. Now, if you don't care about the dollar, well, you might go ahead and hope we have another disaster and that'll be the end of that and start from fresh. You can hope for a revival of the gold standard, what have you, independent of the survival of the dollar. But of course, there's going to be a cataclysmic transition process where a lot of people who have dollars are going to suffer a great deal. I'm not for that. I want to do what can be done for the dollar at the same time that I want to help create an environment where rivals to the dollar are as free to compete and compete on a level playing field as possible. So the question then remains, what do we do with the dollar? And the first thing we have to do is try to normalize monetary policy today, because right now the situation is quite bizarre. The Fed's bloated balance sheet is an abomination. And monetary control is really very in a very doubtful state. So we've got to normalize. Normalize means shrink the balance sheet, but it also means try to do something to discourage banks from holding so many reserves For starters, stop paying them interest on reserves. It's a ludicrous policy. It was even more ludicrous when instituted in 2008. Pay them nothing. Don't pay them negative. Negative creates its own problems. Pay them good old-fashioned zero interest on reserves, for now at least, because that's the only sensible rate to be paying under the circumstances. But policymakers have to also take steps to revive bank lending, and that means undoing a lot of the stuff in Dodd-Frank, which is discouraging lending to sound borrowers. I'd like to mention, by the way, there's plenty of interest rates that aren't zero. They're infinite. They consist of the interest rates on all the loans banks used to make that they're not allowed to make anymore. And so we want to let banks be able to lend at those rates. That is to cater to those markets, which they could do profitably if there weren't legal restraints placed on them, regulatory constraints placed on them during and since the crisis, even though they're not constraining anything that had anything to do with the causing the crisis. So we have to normalize style policy. We've got to shrink the Fed. We've got to get back to old, relatively reliable mechanisms of monetary control. Then we can hope to implement further reforms, which for me means starting out with a monetary rule, and I'm with the market monetarists. So I like nominal GDP targeting, but then again I would, since I was advocating it before they were.
yeah, which is another plug for less than zero. So I want to thank you, George. I highly recommend people to check out his books, his blog. He's also given a number of lectures at our Objectivist Summer Conference over the years. I don't think all of them are out yet. A couple of this last year, one in the Great Depression, which was just incredible. Another, I think, just in the history of the Fed, if I recall. And so definitely look those up. George, I'm sorry we had some technical difficulties, but this was a real pleasure, and hopefully at some point we can have you back.
Appreciate it, Don, and I'd be very glad to come back. Thanks.
All right. This has been the Yaron Brooks Show. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with some updates and a positive ending message, as always.
The Money Changers, the documentary film about banking that God and Washington don't want you to see. In this feature-length documentary, team up with Shylock to examine the evolution, viability, and morality of America's financial system. Stay after the screening and you'll have a chance to participate in a live Q&A with director Chris Mortensen and ARI's Yaron Brooks. Screenings are in select theaters. Get tickets at moneychangersfilm.com.
Join the 40,000 subscribers already connecting with ARI through our newsletter, Impact Weekly. You'll learn about our programs and discover our distinct perspective on today's most talked about issues. Whether you're a student interested in getting updates on ARI's essay contest, an Ayn Rand fan looking for ARI events in your area, or if you're simply looking to learn more about ARI's activities around the country and what we're doing to advance freedom, Impact Weekly is your go-to source for these and other timely updates. Visit AynRand.org/signup today.
Free speech is under attack. Islamic totalitarians repeatedly threaten and kill those who offend them, while our leaders appease the attackers and blame the victims. College students seek trigger warnings and safe spaces to protect them from controversial ideas. The government harasses Tea Party groups for their political speech, and it investigates oil companies and advocacy groups for dissenting from climate change orthodoxy. Why is this happening? What can be done? Find answers in ARI's new book, Defending Free Speech, by me, Steve Simpson. Order it today on Amazon.
Ayn Rand's ideas, as exemplified in her classic novel, Atlas Shrugged, continue to have a profound impact on the lives of hundreds of thousands of people throughout the world. The goal of the Ayn Rand Institute is to build on this momentum and spark a revolution. Rand's ideas have never been more urgently needed, given the political and economic crises facing America, and you can be part of the revolution. You are invited to attend the 8th annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Dinner in New York City on Thursday, September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel. Join Lars Sayer Christensen, founder of Saxo Bank, Yaron Brook, Executive Director of ARI, as well as your fellow RAND admirers for this dinner to benefit the Institute's work. Those registering for the event will enjoy a staged reading of two theatrical adaptations of RAND's first novel, We the Living, in commemoration of its 80th anniversary. We look forward to seeing you September 29th at the St. Regis in New York City. Visit ayinrand.org/NYC and reserve your spot today.
This is the Yaron Brook Show. I'm Dom Watkins sitting in for Yaron Brook. So we had George Selgin on for a great discussion. I hope you tune in for that. A couple other resources I wanted to mention that occurred to me, and these are not George's, so he may think they're garbage, although I'm skeptical of that, seeing as though both of them are friendly towards his views. But one book, which is a short introduction, a more up-to-date one from a free banking perspective that I found really helpful, was Kevin Dowd's The State and the Monetary System. And I don't know if that's still in print, but, you know, we have Amazon today, so everything is in print. And then for the more macroeconomic stuff we were talking about that I think it really fleshes out some of the stuff that's kind of briefly indicated in Less Than Zero and ties it to a lot of Austrian economic thinking is by economist Stephen Horowitz, Micro Foundations and Macroeconomics and Austrian Perspective. And that I find is it's clearly written, but it's hard material, but it pays off enormous dividends. But and then finally, George mentioned his sometimes co-author and mentor, Larry White. Larry White's book, Free Banking in Britain, has a really good theoretical but very difficult theoretical explanation, but his delving into the history of free banking in Scotland and England is just an enormous resource, enormously valuable resource, and certainly worth checking out. So I want to mention some upcoming events we have at ARI. As always, you can learn more about these events and everything else that we have by going to ari.einrand.org/events or following us on social media. You know, we have an Ayn Rand Institute Facebook page. We're on Twitter. What else are we on? We're on everything right now. Snapchat even, which I don't really know what that is. So you can check out everything there. But some, I think a few that are worth mentioning right now. There is a new documentary that Yaron Brook appears in called Money Changers. I think it's just come out. I saw it a month or two ago. It is enormously entertaining, discusses a lot of the issues we've been talking about now, the financial crisis, money and banking, features George Selgin, who we just spoke to, John Allison, a whole lot of other really interesting interviews. And there's going to be a showing of that September 26th in New York, September 28th in Philadelphia, and you can learn more about those at moneychangersfilm.com. There's going to be a reading of Ayn Rand's We the Living in New York by the Austin Shakespeare Company on September 29th. And again, you can find more information about that on our website. Yaron is going to be debating the ACLU. I unfortunately don't have what the topic is right here in front of me, but that's going to be at the University of Pennsylvania Federalist Society September 28th. And then this is really important. Hope you guys can all make it. ARI's annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Dinner in New York City, September 29th. I've been the last couple years. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to make it, so I'm going to be really jealous, but you don't have to miss out. So ari.einrand.org/events, and you can get the details on those and everything else that we're up to. So the thing I want to end on is I was trying to think of, you know, what's positive? And, you know, I could share TV shows, but my taste in TV shows are not necessarily positive. The last thing I watched, binged on was Narcos, which is really great, but not exactly uplifting. But great acting, really interesting story. It's really a mostly true story of the life of Pablo Escobar and the people who caught him. And, it's amazing that they take a story that you know how it's going to end. Indeed, if you know, you can go on Wikipedia and find out what's happening during every step of the way, and yet still leaves you on the edge of your seat. But that's not what we want to leave on today. That destroys the whole purpose of ending on a positive. So I did a Q&A on for a group called Strive Clubs that we work with that takes Ayn Rand's ideas and gets them on college campuses, particularly from the perspective of how you can use Ayn Rand's ideas to help your own life. And during the Q&A, I was talking about, you know, just being successful in your career. And one of the questions I got was, if you had to give one piece of advice to people, what would it be? And I thought, all right, that is an unfair question. So how can I cheat? And so I just offered what I think is one of the most valuable books on that issue, and one that is not everybody's heard of. And that is a book that came out a few years ago by Robert Greene called Mastery. This book, it really takes you through what it means to pursue a creative career, creative in the broad sense, not just an artist, but even, you know, a great businessman or a great, you know, financier or a great economist, to really master a skill or set of skills and build a successful career for yourself. And, you know, starting from how you choose and figure out what should be your purpose, all the way into what to do once you've already achieved enormous success. And you might be familiar with Robert Greene. He's written other books. Probably he's most well known for the 48 Laws of Power. And so if that's the only thing you've read and you were really turned off, you have my sympathies. That book is interesting and valuable in getting the psychology of kind of power seekers and the variants of power seekers, but it's written a little bit too much from the perspective of this is the only way to live, and there's something good in being a power seeker. Mastery is nothing like that, except in the sense that it has a lot of great stories, some really profound psychological insights. But that is, I would say, my number one recommendation if you want a book that is in the, you know, self-improvement genre, but is not kind of canned advice about how, you know, fake it till you make it, put a smile on your face and it will lift your emotions, all of that stuff that is, I regard as, let's say, not too helpful. So that is all for this episode of the Yaron Brooks Show. Tune in next week. I think Yaron will be back. Maybe he won't, but I'm sure there'll be great content either way. I will be back at some point in the not too distant future. So stay tuned and thank you for listening. Oh, I always forget that to follow on Twitter.